Hi, and welcome to the Handbag Designer 101 podcast with your host, Emily Blumenthal, handbag designer expert and handbag fairy godmother, where we cover everything about handbags from making, marketing, designing, and talking to handbag designers and industry experts about what it takes to make a successful handbag. Welcome, Abe Chehabar from AHQ to Handbag Designer 101, the podcast. So excited to have you, legend within the handbag industry. How many years have you been at handbags, Abe? Talk to me.
First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. I've been in the handbag business for about 40 years now. A lot has changed.
So you were basically 5 years old when you started. You just dived right into kindergarten.
Thank you for the compliment. Yeah, no, I was about 22 years old when I started. And a lot has changed over the years. We've learned
just a
lot.
Bit.
And it's been an exciting journey, I got to say. I love the business.
How did you get in?
So my dad had a small shop on Broadway and 30th Street called Giselle Handbag Shop. And it was a mom and pop little, you know, shop selling handbags. And I worked for him one summer and did not go to college. I went straight to work, learned the business, and then opened up my own business about 2 years later and started doing private label handbags for
Was that weird? Did he still have his shop while you were doing that?
He did. He was very proud.
Weird?
No, not at all. We always had a family mentality when it came to business. So it wasn't like mine or his or mine. It was all one, you know? So the initial launch of that business was a rocky start. You know, it was a lot of learning curves, but eventually we found our way and were able to generate some nice business, primarily private label to retailers like in those days, Montgomery Ward, I don't know if you know who those are, or Venture Stores in St. Louis. And we had a lot of regional retailers that are no longer around that, you know, added up to a lot of business. And
did you sell to Marshall Fields? Because that was like, forget it, getting in
We sold to Marshall Fields before they were bought by Target. And yeah, you know, in those days, there weren't too many handbag companies out there offering products. It wasn't like today. You know, brands were almost non-existent in handbags. That started really about 30 years ago when brands started to come into the picture. And it was a different time. You know, every era in handbags has its own beauty and its own, you know, let's say culture. And
yeah.
Every time, you know, when brands started to get introduced into the market, that was an exciting time in the market. And, you know, we started taking licenses and, you know, now you have your own identity. It was a nice evolution to the business. And, you know, to where we are today, where, you know, brands is a major part of the handbag business, whether it's, you know, luxury, moderate or budget, brands are very important in the business. The brand is her ID. You know, my dad always mm-hmm. used to say, every lady needs a handbag. And that's her ID. You know, when she carries that bag, she's kind of saying who she is, more or less, you know, because nothing else she's wearing really says what she is, unless it's a logo, you know, sweatshirt or something. But, you know, the handbag usually is her ID. And, you know, that's why Louis Vuitton does the business they do. And that's why, you know, Gucci does the business they do. And Prada and all these major luxury brands are, it's a whole social economic agenda that's very scientific. And, you know, the customer has an emotional attachment to the brand. And,
right.
You know, once you tap into that, then you have a captioned audience, which, you know, creates sales and so on. So,
okay. I have questions that are overrunning if, because your company has had iterations and so forth. You know, it's funny, being Garmento offspring, as you know, this t-shirt's vintage at this point. My dad always said, like, it should never be about overhead. Now, mind you, he sold Grey Goods and he was the middleman, he was a converter. So it was never about having a beautiful office. And I grew up going to the garment center as a child. And, you know, that's where I heard cursing in a way that I thought was only in the movies and so forth. Yeah. And I had filed swatches and so forth. And my dad's office, which, you know, as you understand, it's also a family business. And, you know, my aunt was there, my grandma was there, my sister was there, my mom was there. I think I was the only one who didn't work there. The office was dingy. And you felt like almost like you were in a factory. And it wasn't until I started my own handbag line and started going into showrooms that I didn't think existed in New York City. I thought if you're doing sales, you're not supposed to be in your own office. You carry your own product to the retailers, so forth. And I've been to several of your offices and they are luxe and beautiful. And what do you think about that? I mean, this is like a controversial topic, like overhead. What are your thoughts?
Right. So, they say you take a diamond ring and put it in a paper bag, and you take that same diamond ring and put it in a velvet box, and it has a different appearance completely. So I think presentation is very important. We try to inspire the retailers with the way we display our products so that they can get inspiration as to how to display it in their stores. So we think about that a lot. We try to make our showrooms look like the retail environment where the customer, as I said, can get inspired and like what they see. We're sticklers when it comes to, every bag's got to be in the right place and the right, location and the right colors with the right matching colors or whatever the case may be. So I think it's very important to have a showroom that, this is our one retail store. This is our one location, so the showroom is our hub. That's our main attraction for retailers to come up and like what they see, hopefully. So yeah, I think it's very important to have a showroom that is sparkling and well
Looks the
designed and
part.
looks the part. And like I said, and it's a casing for a beautiful product.
No, it's just fascinating to me because the contrast of being an independent designer, where you're essentially schlepping around your product in a giant suitcase and taking them out and making sure they're, stuffed and then unstuffed and then setting them up for buyers versus having a showroom is so very different, right?
Sure.
So I would love to talk to you about licensing. Now, licensing and private label. So that is essentially your bread and butter, right? So does AHQ, because I know you've gone in and out of having your own line, do you currently have your own brand right now?
So, what's interesting is about 50% of our business is private label, where we design for other people's brands. So, for example, certain retailers have their own in-house brands. So we learn those brands. They provide us with DNA of the brand and information about the brand. And then we come back and present for that brand. That's about 50% of our business.
That's a competitive business, isn't it, to try and get
It is
that?
competitive. It is competitive for sure. But, when they place an order, it's directly to the customer. You're not taking any risk. It's a low risk business once you get
It's
the
kind of
order.
the dream client, isn't it?
Right. And the orders are pretty large, depending on the retailer. A retailer like Zara can place an order for 800,000 units of one bag in one color, take it, pay you, and you're done. So yes, you are working on lower margin, but it's a much lower risk business as opposed to buying inventory for your brands and then, selling it into the retail community. It does have a little bit of risk. If you guess wrong on a color, then you're going to have to dump it. If, you pick several silhouettes that let's say are not trending, then you have, you got to sell the goods at a lower markup. So the off price, the private label business is a secure business that is no risk. The branded business is a business that people love. It's a great business, but on the same token, it requires carrying inventory and, working the game.
How do you evaluate licenses, the ones that you take on? Like,
Right. That's a great question. That's a good question. So we have several criteria when it comes to evaluating a brand.
have you
And
said
we,
no to some?
oh, we say no every week. I mean, we get offered brands on a regular basis. And again, there's not too many players in the market today that are
Nope.
able to, bring brands to life and distribute them and da 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 and finance and so on and so forth. So there's an abundance of brands out there. We get offered brands on a regular basis. Our criteria, first and foremost, is the recognition of the brand. Does it need explaining? If it needs explaining, we're not interested. Number one. Number two, is there an audience for the brand? Is there a retailer supporting the brand? Is there a retailer that is committed to the brand? Is another very important criteria. And the third criteria is whether or not that brand is being covered by other brands in our own roster of brands. If we have
Conflict of
something similar,
interest.
right. In other words, if we have something similar, let's say French Connection is a junior brand. So if somebody comes along with another junior brand, we look at it and say, are we taking, one plus one and making it equal one and a half? We want one plus one to equal three, So we definitely have a very specific criteria when evaluating brands. We are in the process of looking at something on a more serious level at the moment. Hopefully, we'll make an announcement soon. And there's a lot of opportunity out there with brands. And also, you don't want to take on too much. You want to be able to focus. You want to make sure you're able to capture the DNA of the brand properly. You want to make sure you create a detail or some kind of an icon for the brand that ends up being a detail for the brand. similar to, let's say, the red bottom on the shoe of
Louboutin.
Right. So Louboutin shoes, let's say, has the red bottom. He has that DNA detail that you know it's his shoe. For us to come up with a detail that's, you know, specific for that brand that people will look at a year from now and say, oh, that's a French Connection bag. That's what we call cracking the code. And we do that very well.
How do you deal with the idea of resuscitating a brand that may be coming back from the dead? It's the brand or the license per se is available at a lower price. It had its heyday. You know, perhaps it had been ruined or tarnished by a couple other licensing manufacturers.
Right.
Do you see that as an opportunity, or you see that as too much heavy lifting and therefore it's not worth it?
Yeah, I mean, I really think it depends on the brand. It also depends. We also look at what's going on with the brand in other categories like apparel, you know, footwear. What's going on with the brand in footwear? What's going on in the brand in apparel? Other categories that relate to accessories. And if there's has revived or came back, let's say, it could be interesting. But in most cases, those are, you know, hit and runs. We like longer term businesses, brands that are able to grow over the years and build, you know.
How do you handle, and I know being an independent designer who's had their brand licensed, I had a very unique situation where I was an on-site licensee. I know you've dealt with that too. Historically, taking on a brand that was run and owned by an independent designer, do you see that as something you would do again, or it was too much heavy lifting?
Well, it depends on the designer and their vision and their, you know, outlook insofar as where they could take their business or their aesthetic. There are many talented designers out there that, you know, have potential for major growth. You know, the great thing about the handbag business is that it's a very diverse category.
Yep.
It's a category that has room for innovation and newness. People like newness. They're like, what's next? What's new? So there's always opportunities for new designers come into the market. And, you know, there are designers out there, as I said, that have a tremendous vision for, you know, unique product. You know, look at these brands that came out of nowhere, like Mansour Gabriel. You know, that team had a great, very good, clear vision as to what they wanted to do. They were all about understated luxury, and they hit a market.
Right and, place at the right time with the right product.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you look at that and say, there's always opportunity for newness or new ideas in the handbag market. So that's what I think what makes it exciting about being in the business is watching all these new, you know, trends, development details that are coming out. And so, yeah, there's definitely opportunity for newness on a regular basis in the marketplace in handbags.
What do you think about this? And I'm putting the quotes if people can't see a vegan leather. I mean, personally, I think it's a crock. I think, and the wild thing is that there are a lot of new designers who speak about it proudly. It's vegan leather. And, you know, I've been in the business not as long as you, but I've been through it enough to know the iteration of when it used to be called PVC and now it's called PU and now it's called vegan leather. It's not vegan and it's not leather. It is chemically made. It's still not good for the environment. We had an interesting guy who goes by Tanner Leatherstein, who is the Turkish guy. He's amazing, who rips apart the bags and then sees whether or not, you know, they're real, if they're worth the money. And he actually has his own handbag brand, which not everybody knows. And he has his own handbag factory in Turkey, a leather factory, which not everybody knows. And actually stating that if tanneries are done the right way, they're actually better for the environment than chemically made, quote unquote, vegan leather. What are your thoughts on that? Because honestly, right, selling off-price and off-price or the lower price brands, they're still demanding leather at a fraction of a cost of what leather actually should cost. So can you talk a little bit about all that?
It's a great topic. You know, sustainability is a big, big word. The term vegan leather, I think, is a sexy way to say that it's PU or PVC.
It's whitewashing.
I agree with you. It's a little ambiguous. Yeah, I agree with you. It's a little ambiguous. We do not put vegan leather on our hang tags. It is what it is. But you know, in regards to sustainability, there are today many materials in PU that are made from plastic bottles. So the provenance of where the material's made is in some cases better for the environment, depending on the material. But a big trend in the marketplace that we're seeing right now is PU, PVC being made out of plastic bottles versus plastic.
Do you speak to the factory about that? Are you like, hey, guys, you know, because you're dealing with factories and dealing, you know, and they're producing things on a large scale.
Of course. So sustainability is a global agenda. It's not just the USA agenda. It's also, you know, the material factories in China, in Asia are very, very attuned to it. And they are developing and testing and doing. And they did come up with some really interesting materials over the past year, I would say, that are materials made out of plastic water bottles. So, which kind of helps the environment. But having said that, there's a big trend that's emerging in the market today, which is called DPP. DPP is Digital Product Passport, which is a QR code that's instilled in the bag or the garment that communicates to the customer exactly what components are made within that bag, where it was made, how much of what materials are within that bag. And that can go all the way through to discarding the bag and how it's discarded, all done through this QR chip that's called a digital product passport. Digital product passport is a process that we're looking into as well. Several companies are. I know Coach is doing it. They're way ahead of the market with this DPP, digital product passport.
Yes.
But it is an interesting thing because, you know, transparency is a value asset today when selling product. You want to be honest with your customer. And DPP shows them everything about that product and all the components and where it was made and so on and so forth that they can look up through the QR codes on their computer screen. So we're seeing that as an important trend. And especially when you're using, you know, you're paying extra to use materials that are environment friendly. You want to tout your horn about that. You want to let your customer know you are spending that extra money for the sake of the environment.
Right.
So we're seeing a big trend in that right now, which is kind of exciting. And I think it will separate companies apart that go ahead and, you know, communicate transparency to the customer, to, you know, the end user, and do more business because of that.
I totally agree.
If you ever wanted to start a handbag brand and didn't know where to start, this is for you. If you had dreams of becoming a handbag designer but aren't trained in design, this is for you. If you have a handbag brand and need strategy and direction, this is for you. I'm Emily Blumenthal, handbag designer expert and handbag fairy godmother, and this is the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass. Over the next 10 classes, I will break down everything you need to know to make, manufacture, and market a handbag brand, broken down to ensure that you will not only skip steps in the handbag building process, but also to save money to avoid the learning curve of costly mistakes. For the past 20 years, I've been teaching at the top fashion universities in New York City, wrote the Handbag Designer Bible, founded the Handbag Awards, and created the only Handbag Designer podcast. I'm going to show you, like I have countless brands, to create in this in-depth course from sketch to sample to sale, whether you're just starting out and don't even know where to start or begin, or if you've had a brand and need some strategic direction, the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass is just for you. So let's get started, and you'll be the creator of the next it bag. Join me, Emily Blumenthal, in the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass. So be sure to sign up at emilyblumenthal.com/masterclass and type in the code podcast to get 10% off your masterclass today.
It's so interesting because Isaac Mizrahi's movie I used to show to my students, Unzipped. And I mean, he is obviously a brand unto himself now at this point, as he has been for a long time. And then Terry Agins wrote this book, The End of Fashion. It's her first book, I think, not her second, who used to be head of fashion at the Wall Street Journal. And it's about this whole construct about back in the day when designers were the ones who dictated what the customer should and would buy, right? But once the internet came about and being able to pull the curtain away, like the Wizard of Oz, and actually seeing what's going behind the scenes, brands then started to develop a responsibility. And especially now that customers can call out brands if they're not doing the right thing, so much so that customers are now the ones who are theoretically dictating trends, right? When you're buying denim, it's stressful. Like jeans, it's no longer a skinny jean, a mom jean, a high waist, a low waist, like basically everything is still on trend. Do you think it's still so much that the customer is dictating these trends in terms of sales, or do you think the brand is still very much part of that in terms, especially in handbags?
Great question. So there's no question that today the customer is a lot more educated and a lot more opinionated than ever before. And the reason for that, of course, is the internet. They see everything, TikTok. They're getting so much information that creates for them to have their own opinion and their own direction and their own likes. So to answer your question, you're right on. The customer definitely today has a very strong opinion and say in what they want or what they don't want. But having said that, you know, it's our job as a brand or the brand owner's job to, you know, communicate and lead that customer into what is trending and why it's trending and why it works with various outfits that are also trending. And so it's all kind of connected. But at the end of the day, there's no question that, you know, leading the customer is a very important strategy. And having them get inspired by a various, you know, product. And, you know, you try to communicate what inspiration that, where it came from and why it's there and where it's going and so on and so forth. So I think it's a combination of both.
Do you think, and I know we were talking about this before we started recording, about your licenses per se and taking them on and the power of off-price. You had said that you are taking on these brands, knowing full well that they need to be sold at a certain price point. I'm assuming, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, in the 200, 300 price point range. Going above that might be suicide, essentially, for a company like yours that produces, you know, mass or produces in bulk per se. And then, you know, whatever's left over then goes to off price. Can you talk a little bit about that process and pricing and so forth? And are you the one who's dictating what the retail price is, or is the retailer, and how does all that work together?
Right. So basically, the lines are created, the five brands that we represent, that we design for and distribute for, the lines are created for department and specialty stores for the most part. So the initial launch of these brands is specialty stores, department stores, big box retailers, and so on. And then the sub merchandise, meaning at the end of the season, merchandise that's left over that wasn't sold into that channel goes to the off-price channel. We have limitations contractually as to what we can sell off-price as a company. So each brand has its percentage. For example, one brand says you could do only 40% of your volume off-price versus 60 to the department store channel. So for every $1 million that you do in the department store channel, you can do 400,000 in off-price channel. So there are limitations as to what we can do with that channel. And that's why when we do have available merchandise, it goes very quickly. And we have very strong partnerships with the off-price category of retailers. They are great partners. They buy, they commit, they stand to their word, they pay the bill. They're a great retailer group, that channel. And that's one of the reasons why many vendors, wholesale companies, brands are doing business in that channel, because it's easy money, so to speak.
How much in terms of price, in terms of your cost, how close is it to your actual cost per bag? Like if you're taking it, you know, it's great, you can sell it through. But, you know, seeing the markup, the difference between what it is and what you can sell it at a higher price distribution channel versus off price, is that stressful, or you just know it's great because no matter what, the inventory is sold?
Right. So we have a whole logistics team that estimates, you know, how much to buy per category, per brand, per retailer, and so on. And it's a whole science. So we spend a lot of money and time in, you know, forecasting what the needs are going to be per channel, per retailer, per brand, and so on and so forth. So the leftover product is not really that stressful, really. And again, this is stuff we learned over the years and through mistakes. And the business is a trial and error business, no matter what you're doing, right?
Right.
So I think we have it down to a good, you know, science where we're able to forecast the needs of various brands for various retailers. And of course, you know, there's dialogue prior to the season with our retail partners about what they're thinking versus what we're thinking. And we try to align those ideas and come to a good conclusion. But overall, really, there's One thing I learned in handbags is always an exit. You know, you never really can get stuck with product.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because there's somebody somewhere that will always want it if it's a well-made
bag. There's always
bag.
An exit. There's
That's a good
always
thought.
An exit in handbags.
So let me just get to the part that, you know, where you can really shine here. In terms of bags that you are designing and trends and color and so forth, because this is something that we always get asked, where do you see it going in terms of silhouette, in terms of key points on a bag, like, and what colors do you think are coming and going? I mean, the clutch, to my dismay and happiness, I guess, in some regards, has made a wild comeback. Talk a little bit about that, because honestly, this is like handbag crack to our listeners.
Right. So basically, at the moment, we're seeing a big surge in, like you said, clutches are performing really, really well. Horse bodies continue to do really well, very strong. Anything hands-free is doing really well. You know, everybody's on their phones today. So whether it's a handbag on your back or a bag that's over the chest that they don't have to carry, we're seeing a lot of that today. Like e-function, people want pockets for everything. Utilitarian bags are doing really, really well right now as well. People are getting into common sense buying when it comes to a bag where they want a phone for their pocket. They want a pocket for their phone. They want a pocket for their wallet. They want to have an organizer feature of some sort. So utilitarian design is doing really, really well. Anything hands-free is doing really, really well. And a lot of these, you know, retro shapes, like you mentioned, the clutch, rightfully so, I'm seeing a phenomenal pull on clutches and that kind of silhouette as well.
With the clutches that you design, are you selling them with a crossbody strap all the time? Like always?
Some yes, some no. So we try to give them the option. Some of them come with a wristlet. Some come with a detachable strap so they can wear it with a shoulder or they can put it under their arm. So it's done various ways within the various brands.
And what colors do you think are on its way out? Or is it one of those same thing? It's black, brown, and oxblood, no, regardless. And then it's neutrals no matter what. Do you see like a color that's really popping up other than pink?
Right. So interesting. I mean, everybody knows the number one selling color in bags is black. So that's like usually 40, 50% of the business, which is huge. And then there's a pop color that comes in every season or two. You know, last season it was that whole green thing that was going on, avocado. All kinds of different green colors were selling really, really well. Pink, of course, because of the Barbie movie, started picking up very, very nicely. I think it's on the downtrend at the moment, though.
Me too.
you know, nudes are very, very strong year-round. So we're seeing the, you know, light tans and light taupes performing really, really well. Cognac is also on the way down a little bit. There was a very strong color, but now it's
for a long time.
You know, that medium brown color kind of slowed down a lot. And then, of course, you know, white in the summer does really, really well. So, you know, white in the spring, summer season is about 25, 30% of black business, you know, black handbags. But black is the number one color by far.
Okay.
We do solid black packs on several of our, you know, designs with that just sell like crazy.
Must be nice to know that no matter what, you've got your guaranteed ones and, you know, you're going in saying that we can project that this inventory will sell as a result of it purely being a backpack in black.
Right. And we also try to, you know, be on the safe side as well, because, you know, when you're buying inventory, you're taking, you know, you're buying inventory, you're putting dollars on the table. So whenever we have this rule that whenever we have a new material, we use a proven silhouette. Whenever we use a new silhouette, we use a proven material. So you're always at least 50% right.
Okay. I want to round this out with one question, and I'm really excited to hear why and what you have to say. So 10 years ago, even I'd say, well, not even five, because the pandemic just destroyed everything. I mean, handbags took such a hit as a result of being trapped inside. And I think novelty historically post-pandemic, studies have shown, even if you go all the way back, because I've spoken about this, if you go all the way back to the Spanish flu with the Roaring Twenties after, novelty made a huge comeback because people were ready for new, fun, pop of color, so forth. And you said back in the day, there were very few people making handbags. Right now, there are very few people making handbags. Why do you think that? Do you think it's going to change? I know off-price has a lot to do with that. What are your thoughts on the state of the industry? Do you think more manufacturers or people like you are going to come back? I mean, you spawned from your dad having a shop. And, you know, another time I'd love to hear your story of like, hey, I'm just going to go out and I'm going to go travel and see how production works. Do you think that people like you will make a comeback, you know, within the industry sense?
Right. Good question. So, you know, this industry had a 1-2 punch about 2 years ago where, you know, first we had the pandemic, which everything shut down. People were staying home. There was nothing going on, which took a bite out of a lot of companies' coffers, number one. Number two, right after the pandemic, there was a major logistics debacle.
Yeah, where, boats were trapped, you know, in waters for ages.
The shipping companies, the shipping companies were charging, you know, $20,000 a container, $18,000 a container, if you can get them. And keep in mind, the container only holds like 4,000 stuffed handbags. So, you know, you're paying $5 a bag to bring them in from China. And then the triple whammy was the 41% duty, which you're talking about having an extra 25% because of the tariff war with China. Most companies bring goods in from China. So between the pandemic, between the logistics of shipping logistics, and then the extra duty, many companies couldn't sustain that kind of, you know, hit. So it went from, it's fair to say we lost about maybe a good 8-9 companies in the past 3 or 4 years in our industry that just, that just threw in the towel.
Yeah.
We were fortunate. We were able to, you know, sustain the pain and be able to weather the storm and be able to stay in business. But it definitely also took a big bite out of our company as well. I got to tell you, it hurt everybody in this industry. Thank God container rates are back to normal today. Supply chain is working. It's much easier today than it was 2 years ago. And the business is becoming back to normal. And the fact that there's less players out there creates more opportunity. So there's no question today that there's room for additional, you know, companies, ideas, designs, designers, enter the market. It's actually a great time to enter the market because people are looking for newness. There's a lot of the more of the same going on out there.
Yeah.
And people love to see newness. You know, they love to see new designers, new ideas, new brands. So I think there's always, especially in the handbag category, there's always opportunity to jump in and be able to gain recognition.
Have you moved on from producing in China and looked towards other countries? Because I know other manufacturers like yourself have moved to Africa, other parts of Asia, and so forth.
Yeah, that's a big, big topic. It's actually one of the topics that's keeping us up nights. You know, China is a great country to work with. Our whole team is in China. We're established in China. Are we producing in other countries? Yes, we are doing Cambodia. We're doing some Vietnam. We are starting to ship slowly out of China, primarily because of the, you know, threat with the potential whole Taiwan thing and what's going to be and how the U.S. is going to react. We don't know. So there's a lot of unknowns today with China that could be a potential risk down the road. So we are shifting slowly. But I must say, it's just so easy to work with China because we've been there for 30 years and
right.
We say a half a sentence and they get it. They know what you want, you know.
Right. That learning curve is expensive when you move to new factories.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's for sure. So yeah, I mean, Cambodia is pretty good. Vietnam is good. We are looking at a factory in Bangladesh. Now, these are all Chinese managers or factory owners that are investing in these other countries as well. So you are dealing with people that know what they're doing, but it's the labor force that needs training and getting up to speed.
Right. This has been so enlightening. I mean, honestly, I bet you and I could talk about this till the sun comes down. I'm so grateful for you to have taken your time and sharing your wealth of a lifetime of handbags. I know this is going to be a really well-listened to episode purely because educationally, this was so enriching. And I think we may have to have you back again to talk about what the state of the industry is, because I know if anybody, like you said, so many people threw in the towel just because it was like, well, I've been doing this for 30 years. Why bother beating my head against the wall and waiting for another life cycle to pass? I might as well just move on, retire, cut my losses. But you're still here and I assume you're not going anywhere because this is just who you are.
Yes, we love the business, you know. And, you know, I tell my folks here that nobody goes to Harvard to end up in the handbag business. You grow up in the business. You got to love the business. So, Yeah, thank you for your time and keep up the great work. And you're doing great things in our industry. So keep it up.
How can people learn more, find more about AHQ and buy bags that you're making?
So our website is AHQ.com. There's plenty of information there. And we're happy to share any information. And they can also look us up on Instagram and all those other social media things. We have a whole team that does that here, and I don't really know it well, but AHQ.com is our website.
Wonderful. Abe, thank you so much for taking the time. And we look to see more bags coming from you. Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate and review and follow us on every single platform at Handbag Designer. Thanks so much. See you next time.